From the Sky News Centre at 5, a rape victim says Charlize Theron's comparison of intrusive press coverage with rape is highly offensive. Chris Giles reports.
She could be your mother.
The actress has campaigned against sexual violence.
Your daughter.
That's why some people are surprised at her reaction to press coverage about her private life.
You start, I guess, feeling raped? When it comes to your son and your private life, there are certain things in my life I think of as very sacred.
Jill Saywood was raped at her home by burglars in 1986. She waived her right to anonymity.
I thought it was absolutely abhorrent and disgusted by what she'd said. I think she needs to apologise.
Actress Kristen Stewart said sorry in 2010 after she said seeing photos of herself was like looking at someone being raped.
Family and friends have gathered at Lichfield Cathedral for the funeral of Stephen Sutton, the inspirational cancer fundraiser. The 19-year-old helped raise over £4 million for charity. 10,000 people have joined a vigil in his honour over the past 2 days. Comedian Jason Manford also attended today's service and says it's been a fitting tribute.
It's been amazing, yeah. It's not surprising because he was an amazing lad and it's what he deserves and it's what his family deserves.
Google has launched a new system allowing people to request that outdated or damaging information about them is removed from their search results. It follows a landmark ruling by the European Court of Justice 2 weeks ago, the so-called right to be forgotten. House prices in England and Wales have grown at their fastest pace for 4 years. In the 12 months to April, they rose 6.7% according to official figures. Asda has defended a wearable England flag it has launched for the World Cup after claims it resembles a Ku Klux Klan outfit. The St George's Cross, with the word England on the Red Cross, features a hood. And in football, Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger has ended speculation about his future at the club by signing a 3-year contract. The Frenchman's current deal was due to expire this summer. That's the latest. I'm Zoe Gallus.
Love Bristol, Love BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Welcome, helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward, Mark Wright. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the Murdoch news at 6, from the secret bombing of Cambodia in the 1960s through the Vietnam War and the destruction of Nicaragua, also ordering the killing of Chile's elected left-wing President Allende and installing a fascist General Pinochet. His name is Henry Kissinger and it seems nobody can stop him. And his killing machine is rolling on. Anyway, this weekend, bankrolled by the world's number one oil and banking mogul David Rockefeller, the Kissinger fan club, that is the Bilderberg Group, are having their four-day meeting in Copenhagen, Denmark. Ken Clark, Peter Mandelson, George Osborne, Ned Balls are usually there. Justin Greening is also there this year, the International Development Secretary. And the big media corporations of the Western world are invited too. Those that attend, like the Financial Times and The Economist, they're not reporting. They're sworn to secrecy. Well, that's coming up after the Murdoch news at 6. But first, Our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs of 21, a fairly sunny weekend, but some showers also. Next week, highs of 17, a fairly cloudy week with plenty of showers. Next weekend, that's the 7th and 8th of June. Highs of 17 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for Cabot. That's Mark Wright. Hi, Mark, and welcome to the Politics Show. Well, I suppose I should ask you about Cabot, first of all. What do you know about the man that's given your ward his name? I mean, he's quite a controversial figure, isn't he? Cabot Circus, but he was actually a slave trader, wasn't he?
Well, he was actually from Italy.
He was an explorer.
He was he was Giovanni Caboto.
Yeah.
And that, incidentally, is the reason why Cabot is Cabot and not Cabo. It slightly irritates me when people sometimes think, "Oh, I must have been French, so it must be Cabo," but it's not. It's Cabot because he was Italian. He came over to England. He was an economic migrant, I think you might put it these days. He was looking for jobs. He had some skills. He was a good sailor, and he started touting around to find people who would be interested in him going exploring for them. And he managed to find some people in the local area and set off west and got to Newfoundland.
Now, it was a bit of a race with Christopher Columbus. Are you sure about? Do you know about the dates or who got over there first?
I think. It's usually accepted that Columbus got there just a few years earlier. Of course, the Vikings got over to Newfoundland in like 950 AD or something like that. But they didn't have writing systems, so they didn't record it. So people took a while to recognise that.
Martin, you're nodding there. Do you think you agree with that?
Well, yes. I mean, there's a very interesting book about this, which suggests that in fact the Bristol fishermen possibly discovered Newfoundland before Giacomo Caboto.
That's a long way to go to catch some fish.
Well, yes, because there'd been a cod war with Iceland, which they'd lost, and then therefore they just moved. They moved further west, and of course it was actually Giacomo Caboto was told by Henry VII. So it was a royal. It was a royal trip, just as Columbus was sponsored by the Spanish royal family. And in fact, Bristol sailors that took him out there took him on a wild goose chase twice because they didn't want him to find Newfoundland. There's a very interesting book about this, but I don't know whether it's true.
Well, that's why they named it Cabot Circus, I guess, rather than Merchant's Quarter, because there was this link between the merchants and the merchant venturers and the slave trade. And that was considered quite sensitive. I remember Louis Sherwood, who was a merchant venturer the time, making absolutely adamant that this is not going to wash, calling it Merchant's Quarter, bless him. Anyway, on to the more recent politics, rather than invading or discovering so-called other countries. We've had the election results for the Euro elections, Mark, not being very good for the Lib Dems. First of all, what's your thoughts on the result? Because I think you've lost all of... Am I right in saying you've lost all of your seats in the South West now?
Yeah, I mean, the results were terrible for us. There's no way to argue away from that. They were, I think, at the worst end of our expectations. In the South West, we only had one MEP, but he was a great MEP, Sir Graham Watson. He had been an MEP since the 90s. He was the leader of the Europe-wide Liberal grouping, so he was one of the most influential MEPs in the whole of the European Parliament.
But that's an embarrassment, isn't it, to lose him? I mean, if he's the leader in the European Parliament.
Indeed, it was an embarrassment. It's a real blow. He did a great deal of work for Bristol. He was influential in winning us the Green Capital, which is a Europe-wide award. Across the country, we lost, I think it was nine, we were down to one. It's a brutal set of elections, absolutely, and we're still reeling from it, to be perfectly honest.
Am I right in thinking that it's basically the UKIP that stole that vote? Is it?
No, indeed. I mean, if you look at the actual vote, the vote tallies, it looks like our vote is down a lot and the UKIP vote is up a lot. You might from that deduce that our vote's gone to UKIP, but actually behind the scenes I think there's some shifting. Our vote has gone to other parties and the vote of other parties has gone to other parties, and then that vote has ended up going to UKIP. So we lost some vote to the Green Party and to the Labour Party. Although the Green Party's vote was actually down in the South West, but they picked up an MEP. They effectively picked up our MEP.
Okay, how did they manage to do that? That's a bit bizarre, isn't it? Although they got less votes, they got an extra MEP.
Well, it's
the way... Doesn't sound fair.
It's the way the numbers have shaken out, because the MEPs have to be allocated. There's six of them. They have to be allocated, and because UKIP got such a lot, that meant that some of the other numbers shuffled around a little bit. And the Green Party were actually a bit lucky to pick up that. In other circumstances, UKIP would ordinarily have picked up that extra seat.
Well, I won't pretend to understand that one. But what about the failure of the three main parties, including your own party, to acknowledged that there does seem to be a genuine concern amongst the electorate about economic migration and how that's affected people's pay and conditions, job security, that sort of thing.
Yes, there is a problem there. There is an issue there. I think there are two important factors to say up front. First, the first is that although there is an issue, I think it is the fact that it's been repeatedly blown up out of proportion by large segment of the press over a period of one or two decades has not helped. I think a lot of people who have never seen an immigrant think that, the country is absolutely flooded with immigrants, even when there are no immigrants around them, just because that's what they read constantly. And that doesn't help. The other issue is that there are secondary effects from large number of immigrants coming to the country. They in particular puts pressure downwards on wages of semi-skilled and unskilled jobs at effectively at the bottom of the ladder of the job market. It also puts a lot of pressure on housing. Now, those two are real issues which affect real people. And if you look at the kind of people who are voting UKIP, it's not a surprise that actually these are people who often are needing housing for one reason or another. They either need a bigger house or they've got children or family members who are on housing waiting lists, and they're also people who are in what we'd call semi-skilled jobs where the wages have stagnated not just since the crash but actually since quite a long time before the crash.
The figures are pretty staggering. The last ones were out last month, up in 2013, up to over 212,000, the net migration, that is, so 212,000 more people have come into Britain than have left. So, I mean, that's quite an enormous figure. I mean, how on earth can we house these people, if nothing else, let alone find jobs for them?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a real issue. Of that number, obviously, there are a certain number, I think most of that 200,000 are European Union citizens. And under the treaties of the European Union, they are entitled to come over here. And we are entitled to go over there. It's important to remember that although there are 2 million in total, 2 million European Union citizens in Britain, there are 2 million Britons out living in the European Union, particularly in Spain. Nearly a million Brits alone living in Spain. And the only reason they're there is because the European Union allowed them to go and simply
but
move and
the
buy
problem
property.
Seems to have started as the poorer countries have joined the EU. It didn't seem to matter too much when France and Germany people from there could come to Britain and we could go to France or Germany, but obviously people from poorer countries are going to try and come to Britain for jobs.
Yeah, well, you say that, but actually when Spain, Portugal and Greece joined the European Union, they were very poor countries. In fact, Spain and Portugal were only very recently out of fascist dictatorships when they joined the European Union. But what didn't happen was we didn't get a huge number of Spanish and Portuguese economic migrants coming over. And for a number of reasons, I suspect the weather was one of them, and the fact that the lifestyle is different. Now, the thing about Eastern Europe is that actually countries like Poland and the Slovakia, Czech Republic, some of the other smaller Eastern European countries, the Polish climate is kind of similar-ish to the British climate. I mean, they have harsher weathers, but their way of life is a Northern European, effectively, way of life. And I think they are much more at home with the idea of coming to live in Britain. And it's been very different this time with the new Eastern European countries. Yes, a lot of people have come over and they've come in effectively at the bottom of society and put a lot of demand on housing, school places, and, had an effect on jobs and wages. It's worth bearing in mind that since the in the last year, since controls on Romanians and Bulgarians were removed, there actually hasn't been a massive increase in the amount of Bulgarians and Romanians in the country. That's not changed significantly, but this persistent number, as you pointed to, 200,000, it's not going down. And I think I hate to say it because I'm not a particular fan of Cameron, but he made a speech a day or two ago towards the European Union and to the European Union hierarchy saying, this cannot go on. The European Union cannot go on as it is. And I think he's probably onto something. I think the fact that not just in Britain but also across Europe there are sort of anti-politics, anti-European parties doing very well, I think the European Union does has to pause.
But, I mean, isn't the European Union a bit of a ratchet? Once it gets some rights to do what it wants to do, Brussels, it's not going to then voluntarily give them up. Once we cede, you know, sovereignty to Brussels, they're not going to go, well, OK, you can have that bit back because you're having trouble at home.
No, I think you're probably right about that, but that's a battle that we have to fight and that we have to win. I mean, I'm a liberal and libertarian. I've spent my entire political life fighting the imposition of what I consider to be unnecessary laws and restrictions by either the council or the government. The very last thing I want to see is another tier of government getting on with that. Now, it's interesting that if you look over America, where the constitution of the federal government is very strictly laid out and it's very clear what the federal government can and can't do and can and can't interfere in, even after 200 years of this setup, there is still a strong belief in what they call states' rights, and that it's wrong for the federal government to start poking its nose in all over the place. On both Democratic and Republican sides of the Congress, there are strong believers in states' rights. What we need is a strong European states' rights movement inside the European Union and inside the European Parliament. And, you know, it's sad and ironic because Graham Watson, who just lost his seat, would be one of the kind of people who would do that. But I want to see more politicians across Europe standing up for what they call states' rights in Europe.
OK, so only one MEP left, lost nine. Martin, what are your thoughts about the results of around Europe as well, not just in the southwest here, from the European elections result announced at the weekend?
Well, the Front National in France topped the poll. And they, of course, they're not right-wing in the sense they are right-wing, but they're also calling for a complete abandonment of the trade treaty with the US that's being negotiated by the EU. And they want to, they want protectionism for French jobs. So the right that is rising in the European Union now is not a liberal free market right. And that's got some bad and some good qualities. The good qualities are that the debate is moving away from free markets are what the answer to everything, and you know, patently nobody believes that anymore. But of course, the illiberal aspects of this is the dislike of foreigners and so on. I mean, the German Christian Democrats, who have done reasonably well, openly calling the Front National fascist. There's going to be all sorts of realignments on the right, and you're going to find it quite difficult because, of course, the Hungarian right wing and the Romanian right wing hate each other's guts, a bit like the Russian right wing and the Ukrainian right wing. And this is not necessarily an answer. It was a very interesting, very short letter in The Guardian the other week, said that if we're going to have 1930s style economics, we're going to have 1930s style politics. And that's what we're getting.
Okay. What about the issue of migration? Do you think that was a factor? Mark seems to.
It is, but it's not. It's not. UKIP are not in a position to do anything about migration, even if they became the government. They would have to leave the European Union to change the freedom of movement.
Okay, well, there are two approaches, aren't there? The UKIP approach seems to be, we've got to get out of the EU, and the Lib Dem and Labour approach seems to be, well, we need to be doing negotiation within it. Mark, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there are some areas where we could make some, hopefully, you know, quicker changes. I think, for example, one of the things which has excised people a lot, I'm not sure how big a problem it is, but is this issue of, you know, European Union citizens coming to Britain and then within a relatively short amount of time and claiming benefits of various kinds. I think we probably can be a bit smarter on which benefits are available to European Union citizens who are in the country relatively recently.
But isn't the problem, if people come in and take jobs, then it's actually British people or people who have British passports who are the ones who are having to claim the benefits?
Well, yes, yeah, indeed. But I mean, the European Union citizens are only competing against British citizens for jobs, and British citizens actually do have, you know, a built-in pretty good advantage, which is that they speak the language absolutely and fluently. So I don't subscribe to the idea that any European Union citizen can come over here and just somehow take a job from a British person. You know, I mean, people want people doing their jobs who can speak to the public, who can interact, and who are, you know, and who are up to the job. And it's not the case that foreigners are better than British people at doing jobs.
Well, maybe they'll just take less cash in hand or money in their pocket, you know, at the end of the week than British people will.
Well, that is an issue, and I think, you know, I do agree with the Labour Party on this, that we, you know, we need to get very tough on companies who are bypassing and underpaying the minimum wage. The minimum wage, which I've always supported and is a good idea, sets the minimum level, and nobody should be paying less than the minimum wage. So nobody, you know, nobody on a minimum wage job
but
should
what,
be being
the,
beaten
on,
out of
Mark,
that job because of someone else
what,
on a lower
when the
wage.
Minimum wage doesn't actually pay the bills, it doesn't pay the rent, it doesn't pay the gas bill, the electricity bill, all these are going up and up at ridiculous rate, and food as well.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's a fair point. And again, one of the good things this government has done, which was a Lib Dem policy, is to increase the tax allowance to put effectively £700 now back into the pockets of people who are on a year, back into the pockets of people who are on the minimum wage, because it does make a difference down at the bottom end. Now, you're right, again, another thing that Labour Party are talking about, which I agree with, is, but they're calling it the cost of living crisis. There are these basics to life which the price of which is increasing. Energy is one of them, and unfortunately the cost of energy is most likely going to continue to rise, you know, probably until some sort of wonderful breakthrough in technology is made, because as the world industrializes, you know, there's a much, much greater demand on all of the sources of energy. That's, you know, that's very difficult. Certainly in terms of some of the other things which are, you know, going up, cost of housing, cost of rents, things like that. You know, the housing crisis has not been tackled at all. I think the government's attitude to the housing crisis has been, well, the best way that we can get people to build more houses is to allow another sort of housing bubble to sort of partially appear. And I'm a bit worried that that's not really a particularly good solution to it, although at the moment it is, there's no doubt it is stimulating the construction industry.
Well, there is. Let's move on to some of the stories in the news this week. And on the front page of The Eye today, my favourite paper, I'm not ashamed to say, it's cheap, it's only 30p, also seems to have really good all-round coverage generally, is the front page story today is Coalition hires debt collectors to target public. There you go. You know, the Coalition, it's not just the Tories, Mark, it's the Lib Dems too. Mm. The government is sending debt agencies after 215,000 people who were overpaid tax credits by HMRC. Martin, we did actually, it's not in there, folks, you're looking for it, but it's not there, it's just on the front page of The Eye, I'm afraid. Now, that's funny, isn't it? Because that's the same number as the number of migrants. It's exactly the same, 215,000 people overpaid tax credits by HMRC. Maybe, Martin, you can start on this, because, I mean, we know several people, don't we, who were in the work programme, people who were previously unemployed, put onto the work programme, and then in the work programme, then they were told, you can go on to this wonderful self-employed scheme where you can get tax credits and you can make your living from selling things on eBay and various other slightly dodgy, certainly not proper jobs. And that, what's happening now is the chickens are coming home to roost. The debt collectors are knocking on the door saying, we want those tax credits back.
Yeah, I think this is what's basically flattered the unemployment figures. The work programme, which I've got personal experience of, it's basically collapsed and burned because they've not been able to place enough people in jobs to get the money that they were supposed to get. But the fact is that in order to try and reach those targets, people were encouraged to set up as self-employed, and effectively what you're doing, it's you are unemployed, but you're classified as self-employed. And now, of course, they haven't earned enough to cover the tax credits that they've been given, and therefore the money is going to be clawed back. And this has been a disaster waiting to happen all along, really.
It's pretty frightening. Hundreds of thousands of Britain's poorest people are being targeted by private debt collectors hired by the government after their tax credits were overpaid because of errors made by HMRC. A joint investigation by The Independent and the campaign group False Economy has uncovered the Coalition's increasingly forceful methods of pursuing more than 4.7 million cases of overpaid tax credits, which amount to debts of £1.6 billion. A hardline stance follows pledges by Ian Duncan Smith, Work and Pensions Secretary. I always call him IDS or In Denial Smith. The debt collectors have been hired by HMRC, and they phone the people they're targeting on their mobiles, send them text messages and write to them at home. Some of those targeted say they feel harassed and frightened in at least 80 tax credit cases. Assets have been seized directly. And The Independent makes the point, Mark, that this is affecting Britain's poorest families. Why aren't HMRC going after the likes of Starbucks and the banks for a bit of tax? Why are they going after people who've got nothing?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that, actually. I mean, in this pack that you've given us right back at the end, actually, it does say HMRC raises record $23.9 billion after targeting tax avoidance.
Oh, they're doing some good as well.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, and you know, the thing is that sum of money, $23.9 billion, is absolutely vast compared to the $1.whatever billion it was that you just mentioned.
$1.6 billion.
And, yeah. I've got to say, I don't understand why they're hunting for pocket money, essentially, from poor people when there is flipping great wadges of cash lying around in offshore accounts, which is owed to the British taxpayer. You know, I mean, they should be going after these people. The people getting, you know, text messages and harassment should be, you know, these rich offshore tax exiles. I absolutely agree on that. I mean, I do respect the fact that this government has done more than any other in history in terms of tracking down offshore tax avoidance and other forms of tax avoidance. And I think, you know, I do think that's great. And I think it is sometimes a bit rich for the Labour Party to come back and attack this, given that in 13 years they didn't really touch this problem at all. But nevertheless, there's lots more out there. That's really what we should be doing. That's what we should be using the European Union for, you know, is to put the weight of the European Union to hunt down and collaborate in terms of secret tax bank, secret bank accounts and all that kind of thing, to really hunt out this money. Hundreds of billions is stashed away, which is owed to the nations of the earth in fair taxes. It's not unfair taxes that they owe, it's just fair taxes.
Martin, you mentioned the massaging of the unemployment figures. You agree with that, Mark, that some of this has been going on? I mean, it certainly looks as if these, I mean, £15,000 the work programme companies were getting for getting somebody off of the long-term unemployed. I mean, enormous figures of, and actually what they it seems many of them have done is they've just put people onto tax credits who are now having the bailiffs knocking on the door, and that actually does affect the figures, the unemployment figures. So quite often I believe now what we're hearing is bluster from politicians about massive decrease in unemployment.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, over the last 2 decades, governments of various colours have thought of different ways to massage down the unemployment figures. I mean, the previous government's favourite was disability pay and benefits of various kinds, and in the end, you know, it ended up with nearly 4 million people on that. Effectively, people who... I mean, I think if we're honest, especially as society advances and it does become easier for people with disabilities to work in the workplace now that we've got accessibility and things like that, you know, increasingly people with disabilities can work, and therefore I think it's fair where people can work that they should work. But there are, you know, there are millions and millions of these people. They've been parked out on various manners of being sort of not employed but not unemployed over the last couple of decades. It's, you know, it's a problem that is being tackled slowly, but the unfortunate problem is that, as you say, every time the government tries to tackle it, you do find lots of you know, exceptions and corner cases where they get caught up in it all and are really unfairly treated.
Martin?
I think the fundamental problem is that automation is reducing the possibilities of full-time employment for the whole workforce, whether we've got immigration or not. And in the past, Liberal Democrats and others, the Greens are still talking about it, talked about having a basic income for everybody.
Yeah.
I think ultimately we've not talked about things like that because in the last 5 years we've tried to cross our fingers and hope that we get back to business as usual, capitalism as usual, everybody working in jobs full-time. I don't see that that's going to happen, and we're not going to change our attitude towards this because there's a whole cultural change that's required. If you think about all the stuff about if they should work, if they can't work, frankly, we're not put on this earth to work. We need to reduce the hours that people work, as the French government did in the 1980s, reducing hours to 35-hour weeks. We need to job share. And we need to liberate ourselves from the idea that work is what life's about. And ultimately, of course, this is because capitalism, for all of its failings, is a fantastic system at producing new ways to produce stuff. Basically, Bill Gates was talking about this, robots are going to take over brain surgery, never mind packing in factories. Now, the problem is, if you don't redistribute wealth, really redistribute wealth, you then get a completely divided society with some people with everything and some people with nothing. And we've got to change our attitude about this, and I think you know, the Liberal Democrats in the past used to talk about these things, the radical view, the radical ideas, this blue skies thinking. And, you know, perhaps if you're ejected from government next time, you'll be able to get back to your original programme.
You're almost nodding enthusiastically there, Mark. But look, we've had Steve Comer, who's in charge of your election, is calling on the party leader, Nick Clegg, to resign. I mean, certainly it's a disastrous result. Surely the natural thing for him to do would be just to step aside. But he seems to be limpet-like, clinging on.
Well, it's not clear to me that simply replacing the man at the top inside the coalition is actually going to please anyone at all.
I mean, do you think his performance when he was up against Nigel Farage a few weeks ago was any good?
I mean, if I'm honest, I was a bit disappointed. In the first debate, actually, he was pretty good, and I felt that he won the first debate. I felt that in the first debate, Nigel Farage was a bit ranty and was making up his facts. And Nick Clegg was doing a very good job of dealing with them. I think after that, I think Nick was poorly advised that he needed to be a bit more aggressive with Nigel in tackling his claims. And what happened as a result was that you saw sort of shouty Nick, who was not great. And I was a bit disappointed about how that came out, because we know he's good, you know, in these one-to-one debates, because he worked the floor with Cameron and Gordon Brown at the last election. So I mean, clearly that didn't hurt, that didn't help. But like I say, I mean, in terms of whether he should resign, you know, that assumes that simply replacing him with, for example, Cable would bring some extra votes to back to the party. But I want to know who are the people who think that the Lib Dems being in the coalition is okay, but specifically dislike Nick and would be happy if the Lib Dems were still in the coalition, but with Cable as
leader? But with a spectacular failure, surely it's the natural thing for him to do. I mean, and what you're then doing is you're then saying to the Liberal membership, let's have another go at finding someone to lead us into the general election. And you'll have a year to do that. If you cling on to Nick Clegg, you're going to face the prospect of an equal disaster next year.
I think the issue is that the people who are upset with the Lib Dems who used to support us are the people who are upset with the coalition, full stop. It's not they don't want a new leader. What they want is the coalition to collapse and for there to be an immediate election. Now I am absolutely dead against that. I think it's irresponsible and it's politically childish to deliberately pull down a functioning government just because you can. I mean, I do not want to end up with a situation, you know, to grow a political culture like they have in, for example, Italy, where the smaller coalition parties pull the government down on average once a year over some argument or other. I don't believe in that at all. The coalition was formed for a five-year term to try and get the economy stabilised, to get the country back on track and try and close the deficit. And I supported that goal. And the government, both parties, should be judged, I think, at the end of the 5 years. And so I'm absolutely against courses of action which result in the government being pulled down and you know, emergency elections. And I think, actually, the public would probably punish the parties for doing that anyway.
Now, yeah, but the public like elections, don't they? The public actually rather like an election, and that's where they get their say. We've had this whole thing of fixed-term parliaments, which is an attempt to say that there's going to be no sort of interrupting of the process. It's just going to be 5 years, and that's it. Now, it seems that you know, there's a message here, which maybe this is one of the reasons why a lot of people are trying to hang on to Clegg, is because it keeps the status quo going for a little bit longer. Anyway, we've had also a change of leadership, haven't we, with the Lib Dems here in Bristol?
That's right.
Tim Kent has stood down, and we've now got Gary Hopkins in charge. Tell us a bit about the difference between those two.
Tim did 2 years. I think he did pretty well as a leader in very tough times. Gary has come in. Gary and Tim are certainly quite different characters. There's no doubt about that. Gary has been a councillor for a very long time. He's quite well known in the city for various reasons. He's had strong opinions on lots of things over the years, and he's got a very tough job. Although the Lib Dem group is clearly much smaller now than it was, so in terms of keeping us aligned, maybe he's got a slightly easier job.
Martin, we've also had, I should ask you this, we've also had a change of leadership with the Conservatives on Bristol City Council. That is Mark Weston has taken over from Peter Abraham. Give us your thoughts on that one.
I think that's potentially useful as well. Peter Abraham has been the Tory leader on and off for a very long time. He's the longest serving councillor in Bristol, that's for sure. He's been a councillor for 40 plus years. I know Mark Weston reasonably well. I like him. I think he's actually a leader that the other parties will be able to negotiate with and talk with quite well. I'm quite positive about that.
So we've had all change here in Bristol. Why not at the top of the Lib Dems?
Well, like I said, the situation in Bristol is different. We've just had all change because of elections in Bristol. I think to draw from that the idea that we've just had elections in Europe or in Bristol,
all the political parties are always being accused of not being democratic. Surely this is a chance it's a chance for the Liberal Democrat Party to actually get in gear for next year. It's just simply not going to happen if you don't allow the membership to have their say.
I don't see how simply replacing Nick Clegg with say Vince Cable inside the coalition does that. Like I said, the people who are upset at the Lib Dems are upset at the coalition. They want an end to the coalition. They don't just want a new leader of the Lib Dems in the coalition.
Okay, on to some other stories. More than a million homes are currently empty in Britain. Another one from the wonderful I newspaper, only 30p, and I'm not paid by them. I just think it's a good paper. Britain is in the grip of a worsening housing crisis between those who can afford to leave homes lying empty and those forced to live on top of one another in overcrowded households. For there are more than a million homes lying empty in England and Wales, according to a new study by the Office for National Statistics, which was released today. The Isles of Scilly top the list of local authorities with the highest proportion of empty homes, with one in three in this category. Other hotspots for empty homes include the City of London and Westminster. Most are in coastal areas such as North Norfolk, Scarborough and Pembrokeshire, and likely to be linked to holiday homes. Now, Martin, isn't this just a sort of microcosm of what's wrong in the macro economy, where you've got people with vast amounts of wealth that they could never spend? They're actually doing rather well at lobbying for less and less tax. And then there's others who are on the poverty line and having to use food banks.
Well, that's true, but I mean, focusing particularly on housing has been the Achilles heel of the British economy for a very, very long time. And it's not just something that's happened since this coalition came to power. There was 13 years of Labour government, and they didn't do enough to solve the housing crisis that we face. One of the obvious things you could do, without going completely mad, is you could say that people shouldn't be able to get council tax relief on second homes. Mm. Basically, everybody should have a first home. That should be the principle. And if people can afford second homes, that's fine, but you're not going to get any council tax relief on it. Mm. We should use the tax system to try and ensure a fair distribution of housing. And of course, we should build some social housing. Mm. I believe in Bristol we are talking about doing that. We've got a coalition of all
talking,
the parties.
Talking, but not doing.
Well, that's because the central government hasn't changed the regulations to allow local government to do what it used to do perfectly adequately.
Because the central government doesn't want the housing supply to be there, because that will burst the bubble.
Well, no. Not the point is, if you started building social housing, you might be able to reduce the bubble without bursting it, because it wouldn't happen overnight. It would just change the dynamic.
I mean, making homes for people is surely much more important than, whatever figures are coming out of the Treasury and balancing the books. If we haven't got enough homes for people, well, I mean, what's the point of, well,
but also
having these government?
The macroeconomic effect of having an undersupply of homes is that you then get property bubbles which have to be burst by raising interest rates. I mean, that's probably what's going to happen, possibly before the next election, where the interest rates will have to go up in order to control the property bubble, which could then crash the economy for all of our exporters, etc. Okay. And we've been here before, umpteen times.
Stoking up a bubble?
Well, I think, actually, in terms of how we look at the finances of this, we should go further than that. What we need is a land value tax in this country, a proper land value tax, which means that people with property which is doing nothing, or houses that are sitting empty, they have to pay every year, the same as the people who are next door and who are using that property in some productive manner, or have tenants in their property, or are living in a property.
I mean, if, people have three or four homes. In the old days, under the rates, you would have to pay for each home. By moving over to council tax, which is on individuals, what they've done is they've let people with multiple homes off scot-free with only having to pay one lot of tax. So, I mean, you know, all you need to do, you don't need to have land value tax, surely, just reverse it back to the old rating system.
Well, indeed, the old rating system was a much fairer system, and, you know, one of the really dreadful things that Thatcher did, and that she will always be remembered for, is scrapping rates and bringing in the poll tax instead. The poll tax was then quickly replaced because it was a disaster, but it was replaced with council tax, which is basically a bit like the rates, but in bands, which meant that the rich didn't have to pay too much.
But it was more like the poll tax than it was like the rates, because it was a tax on the individuals rather than the property.
It's a tax on tenants rather than a tax on property owners. I mean, it's important to note that if you bring in a land tax on ownership of property, it is true that property owners will pass on that tax to their tenants in a sense, where they have tenants. And that's the thing that's important. I mean, that where a land value tax falls, and you know, you would expect to set it at a level which is sort of roughly equivalent to council tax for most people. But with the difference it would make is where there's property with no tenants, that property would still be due for the tax. And also, where there are fantastically expensive properties, you know, they would pay a proportion, a fair percentage, rather than, you know, a banded system whereby people in £100 million mansions pay twice as much as ordinary people, when they should be paying 10 times as much, 20 times as much at least.
It always seems that the small people get taxed more proportionally than the big
people. It is, absolutely. The council tax is a regressive tax. Poor people spend a higher proportion of their money on council tax than rich people.
Well, we've got loads of empty offices, which many of which are able to do tax breaks from business rates and that sort of thing. But the trouble is, if you start doing that, surely what's going to happen is people are just going to demolish buildings, saying, well, actually, it's not the building that's worth the money, it's the land. Well, I mean, that's what's happened in the business world as business rates have been put onto empty office blocks. I mean, you go down Temple Way, many of those have just been demolished in the city centre here simply because the people who own them don't want to pay the business rate.
But a land value tax is levied on the land itself. You cannot hide it, you can't get rid of it, you can't dig it and bury it. The land is the land, it's there. The reason this is such a good form of tax is that it's impossible to avoid.
I agree with that, and I think it's good that you're saying this. We had 13 years of Labour government and we didn't do anything about this. Maybe next time, when the government changes, we could find a Labour-Liberal coalition. And this is the sort of thing that we should have done.
Well, if the leadership of the Liberal Party changes, you might have one.
Well, I mean, coming back to the whole dilemma that the Liberal Party... I mean, I agree with Mark that just changing the leader makes no difference at all. What you might have done is walked out of the coalition earlier in the Parliament. And I think, if it's done now. It's too late.
But Nick Clegg isn't going to do that.
I think you might have been wiser to have, on some point of principle, to have divorced David Cameron. But it's too late now.
Anyway, another story. The big four accountants are under fire over the bank audits. This is good old Mark Leftley in the Independent again. The big four accountants that so dominate the bean counting industry, that is to say that the financial services, they call themselves, even if they're not necessarily telling the truth, as we've found in the past, they have come under fire from regulators for poor quality audits of the big banks and building societies. KPMG, there they go again, these people who've got a volunteer, at least they did have up until recently, working with George Ferguson, going through our city's accounts. PricewaterhouseCoopers, that Lib Dem MP Stephen Williams used to work for. Deloitte and EY, oh gosh, who were they? All found themselves heavily criticised for failing to spot the oncoming of the 2007 credit crunch and subsequent economic crisis, when they ran the rule over the numbers of the country's most crucial financial institutions. In its 10th annual assessment of audit quality, published today, that was on Tuesday this week, the Financial Reporting Council found that examination of lenders' numbers continues to fall below average. The big four were essentially accused of not learning from past mistakes. In particular, auditors have failed to challenge banks and building societies on the insufficient money they have set aside against potential losses on their loans. The Financial Reporting Council already launched a huge review of banking audits. So furious have they been by the findings. The report will be published, full report, in November. Now, Mark, this is really important, isn't it? Surely in any kind of capitalist society, that when you get the numbers through as to any kind of company, institution, that they're accurate. Clearly here, what they're saying is they haven't been.
That's right. There's, in my opinion, there's an absolutely fundamental problem here, which is called a conflict of interest. It is not in the interest of the Big Four to be honest about the companies that they're auditing. This is a fundamental problem. And, you know, we can go around this circle every couple of years and shout at the Big Four and say, you know, why aren't you doing this and why aren't you doing that? The system is set up in a way such that it will always be not in their interest to act honestly and genuinely, which means this is always going to keep recurring. I think the only way to deal with this is that the system of accounting and the way this the way this is operated has got to change in some fundamental way. And I'll be perfectly honest to say it's not obvious to me what that change is and how it has to change. But the current system is intrinsically broken and it cannot work. It's not that it doesn't work; it's that it cannot work.
But what about treating inaccurate accounting as fraud?
That's a reasonable suggestion. I think their comeback.
And when they
get
it wrong, sending them to jail. I mean, surely that's the obvious thing to do, isn't it?
I think more of these people going to jail would have been a very good thing. And actually, there was a very interesting article in the Guardian a few days ago, with a report talking to off the record talks with some of the people in the city. And one of the people said, you know, the way to solve this was that more people should have gone to jail for what they did. And I think that could be part of the solution for sure.
So these are the companies to watch, folks: KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deloitte, and that's Ernst & Young, EY. Martin, what are we going to do about this? Because this isn't going away. The last couple of years, they've been talking about these big accountancy firms basically running a little cartel amongst themselves and pulling the wool over the eyes of the regulators.
Even if you had six accountancy firms instead of four, there's a fundamental conflict of interest. I mean, the people who pay for the audit are the banks themselves. Mm. So they pay, and that what they want to hear is that, yes, we're fine and we can carry on doing what we're doing. Now, if the auditors come in and say, oh, no, you're not fine, then they're not going to get the job. And competition won't solve the problem. Mm. This is a delusion. If we had six auditors and they were competing with each other, they would probably be worse, because the banks would be able to play them off against each other. Maybe we should just have one government auditor that audits everything.
Okay, well, that's certainly... What are your thoughts about that? Is that something the government could do or should do, Mark?
We need to get out of the situation where it's not in the interests of the people who are being commissioned to do their job properly. We either need some kind of independent commissioning whereby, you know, maybe the companies needing to be audited pay some money into some sort of blind pool, mm-hmm. and they get essentially an anonymous audit and they don't know who does it, but, you know, the audit is done. Maybe that's a way of doing it. I mean, I think if we were to simply create a new government department, you know, the Department of Audit, that, you know, I suspect that very quickly the companies would get their fingers into the government department and there'd be all sorts of revolving door changes of between the civil servants and the directors of the companies. I'm not sure that would necessarily solve it, but we need to get rid of the conflict of interest at the base of it.
Oh dear, right. Whether we'll do that with these massive big companies that spread right across different country boundaries, the transnational companies, corporations, seems very difficult to deal with them. Anyway, austerity cuts have been blamed for a crisis in our prisons. Soaring inmate numbers and an increase in violence are blamed on biting austerity measures. The prison system is in a deepening crisis, with soaring numbers of inmates, worrying increases in assaults and disturbances behind bars, and the problems will intensify as austerity measures continue to bite, and new research warns. In just 2 weeks, the jail population has leapt by 500 in England and Wales, and tens of thousands of offenders are held in huge warehouse jails. Wow, what is a warehouse jail? Doesn't sound too good, does it? A report by the Prison Reform Trust discloses nearly two-thirds of jails are overcrowded, according to the Ministry of Justice's own definition, stoking up tensions amongst inmates, piling pressure on overstretched prison officers. Martin, now this is pretty awful. I mean, there's all sorts of problems with all sides of the criminal justice system, it seems, legal aid cuts, meaning that a lot of cases just simply don't come to court because the lawyers won't get paid for what they're doing, and also that the prison service itself is finding that it's having to cancel cases because they don't have enough money to pay the staff.
Well, yes, and this is compounded, of course, by the private prisons agenda of the government. So we had, I think it was a prison in Shropshire, wasn't it? A G4S, a brand new prison, state of the art, but it was completely incompetently managed by G4S.
So this is a result, really, of austerity, but it means that actually what's happening is that the criminal justice system in Britain is breaking down.
Well, this is the problem. But we're already, because of austerity, attacking the social infrastructure, including the prisons. Ultimately, of course, if there is a further crash, and I suspect there is going to be a further crash, and nobody should kid themselves about that, nothing has been done to fix the financial sector. Think about the item we were just discussing a minute ago. If there is a further crash, then the social infrastructure will break down. And we're going to have a situation like we have in Latin America, where the prisons are run by the gangsters because the state simply doesn't have the resources to control them. And if you think that's can't happen, I would see Latin America coming to the United States, and what goes on in the United States coming to Britain. So let's not kid ourselves. That's a definite possibility.
Mark, according to the figures, 1,575 serious assaults took place in prisons last year, the highest number for a decade, and a rise of more than 300 over the previous year. Meanwhile, 23,000 incidents of self-harm were recorded amongst inmates, an increase again. 215 deaths in custody, the highest on record. Also, prisoners are being locked up for much longer than they're being given less time to out of their cells. This just sounds like the whole system is slowly grinding to a halt, and also that we're not really delivering the human rights to people who, you know, people are being deprived of their liberty, but then they're being deprived even further once they're in jail.
Yeah, this is quite worrying to see this. I must admit, I'm slightly surprised to see it, because actually crime has been falling quite sharply over the last 5 years or so.
Well, we've also heard whistleblowers from the police saying that the crime figures are being massaged, and those whistleblowers are being bullied and kicked out of the police. That was a story about a month and a half ago.
Okay, I must admit, I hadn't seen that. I think in general I think it would be difficult to argue that there hasn't been at least some drop in crime over the last 5 years. I mean, it's been quite substantial. And you would expect in a scenario where crime is trending down that there ought to be less people being put into prison. I mean, there are certainly less people going to trial. So it's difficult to see why the overcrowding is continuing at this rate. I must say that I'm absolutely opposed to private prisons in principle. Yeah. I was opposed when the previous government did it, and I've been opposed when this government does it. And that it goes back to this issue of conflict of interest that we were talking about in the previous item. We've now increasingly got companies out there, and it's in their interest that there is more people in jail, and by extension, more crime. And it's bizarre that we're setting up a situation whereby there are people who benefit, companies that benefit, if there's more crime, or if there are more people going to jail. And we mentioned the US a lot, but the US has got an absolutely terrible situation where you have private construction companies joining up with prison unions to argue for tougher sentences and new criminal offences and new laws to be added to the books in order that more prisoners are generated, in order that both of those groups can benefit from it.
They also had a couple of judges jailed in the States for taking bungs from private prison companies for giving custodial sentences when they shouldn't have been.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a disaster waiting to happen. I mean, it's only slightly less mad than having private armies, you know, where quite obviously, if you have a private army, it's in their interest to stoke up wars, and they do and they will. You know, and it's perfectly obvious that private prisons are a really bad idea. In terms of the troubles that are going on inside them, like I say, it's a bit perplexing to me that the overcrowding in Britain should be continuing when, you know, there ought to be right now being less demand put on these prisons. I mean, it's never a very trendy thing for politicians to say, but I think we need to look again at the kind of people we're sending to jail. I have never been a fan of prison terms for drugs offences, and I've never been much of a fan of prison terms for non-violent offences, you know, frauds and things like that. Frankly, these people were...
Apart from at KPMG or the banks.
Well, yeah, I know, it's ironic, isn't it? I just said that. But, you know, in general, where you know, non-violent offences, you should get the people where it really hurts them. And if people have, you know, if people have evaded taxes and things like that, you should just simply seize their assets, seize their money. That's what they're really after. These people are greedy. That's why they're, you know, that's why they're.
I suppose that might also concentrate the mind of KPMG or PricewaterhouseCoopers if half of their assets were seized, mightn't it? Anyway, Martin, what about the prison story?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, I mean, the fact that we've still got private prisons, I agree with Mark that that's
wrong. But this was a Labour policy, wasn't
it? Well, indeed it was, and I think what's happened is, you know, we've got a Liberal Democrat activist and a Labour activist all agreeing about land value taxation, private prisons and so on. But because of the broken political and economic system we've got, these things have not been on the agenda for a generation. Mm. And this is why people are turning their backs on politics. We all agree this is silly. We had 13 years of a Labour government. Did they do anything about council housing? Did they do anything about private prisons? No, because we were told we've got to carry on, we've got to work within the consensus. And of course, that consensus has been dragged relentlessly to the right throughout my adult lifetime. And we've now got into absurd situations. But ultimately, of course, this is like a pressure cooker situation.
Well, two of your main people, Martin, Ed Balls and Peter Mandelson, are both right now in this hotel with the Bilderbergers over in Copenhagen, sitting down with the richest people in the Western world.
Some liberal from the cabinet may also be there as well. Mm. It's the sort of thing that Vince Cable might be invited to.
Well, Shirley Williams was last year. I don't think any Lib Dems are. I think the Bilderbergers have taken a look at the Lib Dems.
That's sad for the Lib Dems have not been invited to the Fox's picnic.
maybe the Lib Dems aren't going to do very well at the next general election.
That's how I would see it. I mean, Balls and Mandelson are there to be given their instructions by the powers that be. That's what it's about.
And so where does that leave democracy?
Somewhat denuded, but ultimately it's going to bite back. I mean, we've not had a serious conversation about things like basic income, social housing, private prisons, all the things we've talked about. And in actual fact, that those should have been on the agenda 20, 30 years ago, but we're not allowed to talk about them. It's considered irresponsible to question things like private prisons.
What are your thoughts about what Martin's saying there, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, with regard to this meeting, money is power, and big concentrations of money are effectively big concentrations of power. And what, you know,
can money buy politics?
I suspect it can. Yeah, I mean, not explicitly. You don't get people turning up with wads of cash and handing them out to politicians. But it's more discreet than that. It's directorships and friendships, and we've got a good deal coming. Do you want in on this deal? Things like that. It's networking and business contacts, and this sort of super rich elite who sort of stride the globe looking for new investments, new opportunities. They're always interested in setting the political weather in the direction that they want it. You know, I think they were probably a bit worried when the whole Occupy thing broke out across Europe. For various reasons, I don't think that Occupy were really astute enough to realise that they needed to have some clear demands and they needed them quick, and then that sort of all fizzled out. And I think a lot of the super rich think, well, we're nearly back to where things were before. So,
well, the Bilderbergers had their own sort of little event. Actually, it was Lady de Rothschild and Prince Charles, who are very friendly with the Bilderberg types, this sort of British elite. Royals and finance heads were amongst those looking for practical ways this week to renew the capitalist system. London hosts world leaders in a debate on fairer capitalism. Prince Charles, former US President Bill Clinton, Bank of England Governor Mark Carney, and fund managers representing a third of the world's investment income descended on London on Tuesday in a mission to try to solve capitalism's current problems. Martin, what do you make of this? A lot of the press coverage of it was pretty scathing, actually, saying, well, who do they think they are? They're saying, actually, ultimately, one of the main thrusts of this is that they want to stop governments taking their money off them.
Well, I think what's happening is they realise that they're under attack, and therefore they're trying to decide how they're going to deflect that kind of attack. So they're talking about how they can reform capitalism, etc. I think we're reaching a point where it's beyond reform, I'm afraid. I suggested earlier there's going to be a crash. I'll stick to that. There's going to be a crash. And when there is a crash, we're not going to be talking like this anymore.
Prince Charles and Linda Rothschild, do you think they're going to reform capitalism?
I thought it was quite interesting what Prince Charles said, actually. I mean, in the past, he's had a reputation for saying fairly bonkers things, grey goo and all this kind of stuff. Actually, what he said was perfectly sensible and pretty mainstream. He got into a lot of trouble with it because as the monarch, he's not really meant to get involved with those things. He was in hot water already because of what he said about Putin, but he wasn't tremendously far off the mark on that either.
He's a massive landowner, a big landlord.
He's only recently started paying tax.
Is he going
to? Sorry, he can afford to be a bit generous.
And he's up the civil list as well, hasn't he? Will we take him seriously? Is Prince Charles really going to be the man to steer capitalism and find its conscience?
I think it's actually very helpful for him to be saying that. Like I say, I mean, it's, you know, he's getting himself in hot water because of his position. But
he's saying it, but he's not doing it. I mean, for example, last year he has no power to do it. Well, he does. I mean, he's taken over, for example, the land which is used to distribute all of the where owns the Waitrose distribution depots, for example. He secretly bought that land. He wasn't telling anyone that done it. He did it his level best to hide it. He's also spending hundreds of thousands of pounds on lawyers to try and stop us finding out what he's saying to so-called black spider letters. I mean, if he, you know, people would trust him surely more if he was being a little bit more open and spending less of the rent that people are paying to him on things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely fair that those letters should be published, actually. If he's attempting to have influence on the political system, then we need to know about that. In terms of his business dealings, to be honest, as long as he's paying his fair taxes and as long as he's not breaking the law, I don't actually particularly care that he's not telling people what he's up to. You know, lots of other rich people don't tell people what they're up to. That's not the problem that bothers me. What bothers me is when they don't pay their fair taxes or when they have a different rule set applied to them.
Okay, anyway, thanks very much. That was a Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward, Mark Wright. After the Murdoch news, we go to Bilderberg.
Something that really, whilst it may be incredibly unfortunate, is also part of your own media landscape. It's something, you know, you're in the media, you're a celebrity.
People in Lichfield and from all around the country have been paying their respects to Stephen Sutton. The 19-year-old died of cancer earlier this month after raising millions for the Teenage Cancer Trust. His funeral has been held at Lichfield Cathedral. The teenager's head teacher, Stuart Jones, says he never gave up.
On being diagnosed with cancer, Stephen immediately demonstrated his amazing resilience. He was absent from school only on the days when he was undertaking chemotherapy. It was no surprise that Stephen achieved top grades across the board.
The case of a Sudanese woman sentenced to death and forced to give birth in chains because she won't renounce her Christian faith has drawn condemnation from the international community. American officials have called the treatment of Marianne Ibrahim horrific. Supermarket chain Asda has defended the sale of a wearable England flag, which has been likened to a Ku Klux Klan outfit. A spokesperson for the company says it's simply a flag with a hood, nothing more, nothing less. In sport, Arsenal have confirmed manager Arsene Wenger has signed a 3-year contract extension. His new deal keeps him at the club until at least May 2017. And England's preparations for the World Cup step up significantly tonight. They face Peru at Wembley. It's the first of 3 pre-tournament warm-up matches. Manager Roy Hodgson says he'll be fielding a strong team. That's the latest. I'm Zoe Callis.